Hello all, Group Talk here with more amazing group topics. Today's topic is focused on the triangle of self-obsession. Now, we have been talking about this with the group all week long, and we help to provide a visual of this triangle. At the peak of this triangle, it is identified as anger. At the left of this triangle, it is identified as frustration. And at the right of this triangle, it is identified as fear. Now, we have been continuing our talks about how to stay mentally fit throughout our day, throughout our week, throughout our year, and in work situations, relationship situations, and addressing our singleness. And so Group Talk provided some information, or we talked in detail about the anger that is sometimes triggered by the repeating of a behavior. It can be triggered by our internal punisher that we've been talking about. You know, that little voice inside that tell you, no, maybe we need to wait. We need to be more careful about the things we pick and choose and do. And while that is okay, it could also be paralyzing. We talked about the frustration of being in whatever our situation may be. Sometimes I'm frustrated at the energy I have for things to move a bit faster than what they are. So there I have to practice patience. Here's where we suggested, and my team and I, we also wrote it out as for ourselves. We were talking in one of the podcasts about creating a personal affirmation. And this personal affirmation, it was suggested that we use the letters in our first name. And for every letter, we were to provide a word that described you, us. And so myself and a few others have completed that task. And I find that it helps me, or it reminds me, to take care of me first before I go out and attempt to help others, right? And so I hope you guys enjoyed that little quiz, that little action step, because we like to think that we're taking action and we're just not on here spinning our wheels and just talking to be talking. I just want you to know that whatever is put here in terms of a quiz or a suggestion, Group Talk is implementing that as well. I also want to remind you that if you have the anchor and you're listening on Google Play, there is a button there that says you can leave a message. But here's the update. Group Talk is attempting to, for the first time ever, attempting to run a group on the podcast with all members on Sunday. And it appears at this time that it will begin, we can begin at noon until it's over. be from noon to 1 or noon to 1:30. And I'm hoping that you guys will be available for this live radio taping of group talk and other callers. Because I'm tired of hearing my voice. I like to hear from someone else. You know, I always like to be fed so that I'm not the only one, you know, in the wheel, right? And so I'm going to say goodbye for now. And just to reiterate, the topic for tomorrow's live radio group is on the triangle of self-obsession and how important it is to work on those three areas for our continued mental health. I'm going to say goodbye for now and thank you for listening.
I have to be associated with hallucinations or auditory commands, right?
Usually,
you have non-psychotic schizophrenia or not?
Not really schizophrenia.
Not really.
Okay. I mean, you may have
schizophrenia equals psychosis.
Has to.
Has.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's part of the precursors to
okay.
it. There are different types that go under, especially with the new diagnostic manual. There are those that are in the schizoid family. Paranoia, where you believe that somebody is, but it's still grounded in reality. So because it has that reality component, it's still believable. It's not like you're saying that aliens are chasing you.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, you CIA,
right,
things like
right,
that.
Right.
It's
right.
doubtful because, you know,
right.
what have you done that would actually warrant the CIA chasing you or the FBI or some
right.
entity?
Mm-hmm.
But there is some paranoia
right, right.
that is there.
Because there is a category of depression with psychosis,
mm-hmm.
right?
Absolutely.
So how do you distinguish between depression with psychosis and schizophrenia?
Goes back to the diagnostic manual, because
mm.
there is definitely overlap.
Or maybe it's a question of duration.
There's there is definitely
right.
a form of duration, because in order for depression to be diagnosed, the person has to be depressed for at least 2 weeks at minimum.
Right.
However, with schizophrenia, in order to warrant a diagnosis, you have to be having psychotic symptoms for at least at minimum 6 months.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
That helps.
So it is the duration,
yeah.
right? Do you remember my patient, a young woman who had lost her son to ACS,
mm-hmm.
and there was this, and she would come in and constantly report seeing these things. And I think I checked
mm-hmm.
with David once about that, and he was very clear about some symptoms that I need to pay attention to
mm-hmm.
in order for me to do a better assessment, right?
Mm-hmm.
And while those things were very present, when she met with medical, there was no medication offered. I remember toward the last two sessions, right? She said, "Do you think I would do better if I had medication?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Well, you think about that,
mm-hmm.
right?" Because even though she was asking, inquiring about that,
sounds like she was open to it.
She sounded like she was open to
mm-hmm.
it, but
mm-hmm.
at the same time, I think that she was also trying to fill me out in terms of, is that something that you think I need? You know, we're in these sessions and you never want to say anything to me about it. And I think that was her way of sort of feeling me out to see what my response would be about her needing the medication, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's very, very, very smart young lady, but she was very paranoid about any kind of information about mental illness getting out, and for fear that, you know, ACS would use that against her. So I got that. But when she told me about the little monsters with red eyes that she's seen on the way to the
mm-hmm.
session here,
mm-hmm.
I go, hmm,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And she talked a lot about demonics.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
and demons and faces mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. curtain and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure where to put that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also can do with culture. She was of Latina culture, and there's a lot of blending of both the Christian religion as well as the
Santeria.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of mention of this, because if you a lot of times what they'll do is, if they can't put something into words, they try to describe what it is that they're seeing, because they might feel unease, and in their mind, because the mind craves answers. So if they feel like they're being watched, it's a lot easier to think of it's an evil entity watching me.
How long has she been sober when this happened?
I'm going to say at least 90 days.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Okay.
90 to 120 days.
Right.
And the most intense sharing came toward the end of her sessions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she was able to describe what her aftercare would look like,
mm-hmm.
right? She too is over at 90. She's in that peer-to-peer group, which is excellent,
mm-hmm.
right? The other young lady, she's still doing well with family,
mm-hmm.
Family to family, right? And she called me the other day to ask about the Section 8 voucher what she failed to hear in our sessions was that you will need to register as homeless before they will even consider
mm-hmm.
your case.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what she had been doing, and I guess ACS hasn't found out about that yet, is that she was living with her sister, whom the baby was left in her care. So that was real tricky right there,
right?
And her and the sister had this, I think I shared with you guys, her and the sister had this huge fight.
Mm-hmm.
She had come home one day, and the sister was sitting in the dry bathtub, you know, just rocking back and forth, and the other kids, her baby in a playpen, and the sister's son, who walks around, were just like screaming. And she was not taking care of it. And she said, I came home early and this is what I found. So the sister is sort of unstable, right? As well as she. She did report that it's a family thing, because their mom was the same way, right? But not much came out of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. You know, they sent her for the parenting class. And here's the shortcomings on this. They sent her for the parenting class, but she was never evaluated. Toward the end, they assigned a outside psychiatrist and therapist to her that she was willing to build a relationship with.
Mm-hmm.
She had missed a couple of sessions with him, or he was away on vacation or some nonsense, right? So I thought that would be helpful, and hopefully she addresses the PTSD, because
mm-hmm.
she is a severe DV individual. Severe,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Right. And, you know, going back to the piece that we were originally talking about her with the, whether it's hallucinations or things like that, and I find that, we can't just outright call the patient out and be like, no, you're not seeing these things. These things are not real.
Right.
First, we have to kind of help them open up about talking about this. Sometimes it's the first time they're really even sharing it.
Mm.
So we have to kind of get in on, kind of cooperate with them and
validate,
validate
yeah.
what
they're
what
mm-hmm.
it is they're seeing, because that's
and that's
real
exactly
to them.
What I did. That's
right.
exactly what I did.
It is real to them.
Yes.
And then, and then once we've gained their confidence and their trust that we are not judging them for what they're seeing, now we can start reality testing. Talking about what kind of feelings and things like that are being brought up by them seeing these apparitions, these entities, or what they're hearing. Because it's very real to them.
Do you think that when, because this was some of my thoughts, like when she actually secures her son is given back to her, that kind of thing, and if by chance she is still meeting with this outside therapist, she may be more willing and more comfortable, less afraid to then go in and deal with that that part of it, right? Because I'm thinking that a lot of her resistance to, you know, to the medication, this kind of thing, all had to do with her not wanting any negative reporting because she wanted to get her kid back. And she said something so profound in her last group session, and that was, I came here to get my baby back. But what I discovered was that I needed the help too. That was profound for me.
So she was a cutter.
She was not.
Okay.
She was more. I thought it was delusion.
Right.
Because
no,
she would talk
she
about.
Yeah.
Too. She would talk
okay.
about these demons with
yeah.
the red eyes, and she would talk about. You know.
Yeah.
And, but you know what? And you said something to me that was interesting during that time, about her abuser. Now coming, being with her, because he's the baby's father, being with her on those visits, you know, going with her there, waiting for her out in the waiting area. And it was those times that she came in looking sort of, you know, this way. But when she came into the session and it was just she and I, she would talk in a very confident manner. She says, I know how to say no, you cannot come into the apartment. No, you're not here to see your son. You're here to just hang out here. You cannot sleep on my sister's couch. You cannot come in. Now, wow, that was major.
But you lost touch with her.
Well, no, she completed.
Well, she's completed.
And she took the, and she's at NAPMI. And she's doing peer-to-peer.
Oh, wow.
And she's interested in becoming a counselor.
Yeah.
Sure, and she can do it.
Oh, great. Yeah.
She can do it. So when you hear that...
Where's the child now?
Still with the sister. They were going to, her last court date, they were going to reduce the... her what do they call that? She had to have supervised supervisions.
Okay.
And they were going to remove the supervised supervisions.
Right.
And so that was great. And she has these pieces in place. And I spoke with the therapist that was assigned to her, and he felt that she was doing good. And I said, yes, she's doing good. I mean, like, she's not using. But you remember, that was the other piece. Remember, she was very sort of lack of a better term, not willing to talk about the cocaine that she was using for fear that the amounts would be recorded, or the fact that she was saying that this is what she was doing. I got all that.
Right.
I understood that totally, right? And I allowed her to look at her note as I was typing it through, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that she could feel confident in that. This is what is being written, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of thought that when he was somewhere around, it triggered these monsters that you thought about. Being you know, up in Connecticut, I think it was, and they must have been living out in the woods or something, because they would be driving, he would kick her out of the car while she was pregnant, and she would just be out there in the dark. There's no lights there.
So it's like a sort of PTSD.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
Last week when you were gone, we had an incident here that I was discussing with Pasquale, where a patient of mine was abused, actually assaulted by another member of one of our groups.
Ooh.
Yeah, unfortunately. So this patient had struck up a rapport with this other member, group member, based on a need that she had, which was for resources in her shelter housing facility. And so this other group member seemed to have something to offer in terms of help, or, you know, resources, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so they met up and went out, and the person who was my client was kind of seduced by this other group member,
mm-hmm.
using with alcohol as well,
mm-hmm.
and kind of also physically.
Mm.
So then they went back to the facility to for her to get the whatever it was that was being offered,
mm-hmm.
clothing or, you know, whatever
mm-hmm.
it was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My client was assaulted and came to me the next day in session, and I now feel very kind of ambivalent about how I handled it, because she expressed to me having had sex with this woman. I'm feeling tremendous shame as a result of having sex with her, because she wasn't a lesbian, and, you know, where did this come from? It wasn't, you know, it sort of felt just somehow, you know, she couldn't really get her head around it, and she felt very, very shameful about it. And so we talked, and the way this all came about was that she said, well, I think I want to change groups. And I said, okay, so what's going on? She said, well, this happened. And I said, okay, so anyway, getting back to the change groups, do you want to change groups? And she said, no, I think I want to talk to her, you know, risk seeing her again and have a conversation about what happened, and then I'll decide whether I want to change groups. So I thought, well, that was, you know, she said, I don't think it's a good idea just to kind of avoid her. So I thought, okay, that's really good. And so we talked about the whole shame piece, and where I went with it was, well, what's the shame about, you know? And so we were talking about it, and I said, because as far as I can see, nobody was hurt, you know, and this happened. I mean, okay, you may not identify it as gay, but you know, it's not like anybody, there's nothing wrong with what happened, you know? So I just was saying, well, why do you feel shame, you know? So anyway, so we sort of talked about that, and but at the end of the session, she said, okay, you know, I feel at peace what the conversation with the person might sound like or how it might go, you know? So she left, and anyway, the next time that I came in, I understood that she'd actually been back to talk to clinical, because she actually had realized that, in fact, the whole incident was more of an assault than, you know, than a sexual encounter. It was more of a sexual assault.
Mm.
Based on, she felt, a power differential. In other words, this person had some resources that she was, you know, kind of wanted, and the other person was kind of in more of a, there was a power imbalance in there. Anyway, and then, you know, that she felt that during whatever happened, she was having flashbacks to, you know, some previous sexual abuse history in her background. That she was finding, you know, reports and, about the incident, both, I think, with the housing facility and, in fact, with the police. So I felt very, kind of, I don't know what I felt. I just felt, wow, I felt like maybe I just mishandled it, you know, because I didn't come out in our session, you know. It wasn't like till 2 or 3 days later, when I guess she'd had time to kind of think about it. I don't know. Anyway.
I think that was normal processing. First, she didn't feel threatened, and she didn't feel, you know, and that allowed her to get through that. And then after having some time to think
mm-hmm.
about it, she became a little bit more specific about what took place.
Mm.
And it was good that it was, for me, I mean, like, I think that was good.
Mm.
I think it was good.
I mean, plus, you know, we can only go on what the client ever gives us. You know, we don't know.
Yeah.
We weren't there. we don't know what happened. All we can do is, based on the information that they're at, where they are in their process, and help them process further. But it, you know, we can't know what we don't know.
That's right.
Just like they can't tell us what they haven't processed through yet.
Exactly.
I guess I sort of I felt like I was maybe a little in sort of trying to sort of just say, well, where's the harm here? You know, and you know, when she first started to talk about it, she was very kind of, her body language was very kind of defensive, you know, and she said, oh, I just want to, I don't know what to say, I just want to curl up. But this was like the second or third time I'd met her, and in previous times when I'd met her, she'd also described other incidents where she felt like just hiding under the desk or under the bed. You know, this was something that was kind of, you know, sort of behavior that was
a coping defense,
some sort of
mechanism,
you know, protective thing. And,
yes, yes.
And so she was doing that, and she was really still very raw, you know, and perhaps I could have picked up more on that and say, okay, what's, you know, what's going on, you know?
Not really.
But the thing is, though, that she already, she gave a name to it. She said that it was she.
Mm-hmm.
So why what other context could if it walks like a duck, looks like a duck, and quacks like a duck, we're going to go with duck until we're told otherwise.
Right.
Right.
You know, you did the best you could with the information you had on hand.
Sure.
So I see,
I mean, yeah, granted, our jobs would be so much easier if we had the ability to read minds.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't.
Even though they think we do.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't you know that?
So,
you didn't tell me that, so why would I know that? I didn't know that, right?
But my other client was also trying to get his kid back.
Mm-hmm.
You know the one I'm talking about,
mm-hmm,
I think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Came away from his latest court hearing. So upset that he hadn't been given custody, although that was never even the focus of the session, the court session, the hearing.
Mm-hmm.
He did come away with supervised visitation, which was, you know,
huge.
Definitely progress, right?
Yes, yes,
but
huge.
He was still expressed such resentment at that outcome.
Mm-hmm.
That he said he was going to go to the house of where his son is in custody with his uncle or cousin or whatever it was, and, you know, commit some kind of, you know, like he felt like burning the house down or doing something,
right,
you know,
right,
quite radical.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
mm-hmm,
you know, violent, aggressive, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a bit of a, you know,
mm-hmm,
I mean,
mm-hmm,
I don't know what it does says to, you know, in terms of his mental health stability, which of course we've never had. We've never had any kind. He's never had any kind of assessment. That's
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we don't know really what's
no,
you know,
no
how,
idea
how much talk about reality.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly.
And apparently, he had a relapse that he reported in group this evening.
Oh, did he?
Yes.
Mm.
Cannabis on the 25th.
Was that the day before the court hearing? Yeah. Yeah, I think he did.
Mm-hmm.
I think he did either smoke the day before. Yeah, I think I knew about that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So he was, but even in...
And the reason for that, sorry, he explained to me, was that he did. He smoked the day before going to court because he was a bit sort of nervous or something. And maybe he thought that it wasn't going to show up if he had some kind of screening, but he wasn't aware that... It wasn't until he saw his lawyer the next day when she said, you know, you need to have a year's sobriety if you really want this custody thing to actually, you know, work out in your favour.
Mm.
So he's, I told him, you know, I said, listen, that means you're going to be here for a while. So you mean, he said, oh, so the fact that I smoke marijuana means my sobriety date, you know, starts again to this week, like the 25th? I said, yeah.
Mm.
It's like totally sort of not relating the alcohol, the fact that he's been alcohol free since July, that's what he's focusing on. So I can pop away at my, you know.
Mm-hmm. there's a delayed something there. Yeah. Like, yeah. It could, I'm not sure.
He said that he was tired, but it seemed like he was out of it more than usual this evening. Like, he was not present.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes, like, you know, he usually is, like, present, like, he's looking at people, but then he goes, like, off on his tangent. Mm-hmm. But at least he's, like, focusing on what people are saying, whatever is penetrating is completely different.
Mm.
But he was just, it looked like he was nodding.
Mm.
Mm. Okay.
You know, description of mania, I'm pretty sure they're at different levels, because he can be high, he can be low. You can tell when he's spiraling down. You know, it's not just, and it could just be as simple as the disappointment of not getting employment yet, and knowing that there's money sitting there for his son and whatever else the uncles and everybody else is using it for, because that's his whole thing. That's his whole focus. They only have him there because he gets this money from the mother, and so that's what they're using him for. And he's just like so very angry and bitter. And so whenever you attempt to talk about what happened prior to the son being removed from the home, he struggles with that. It's almost like the young lady I was talking about.
It's like, well, yeah, I fell off the wagon. My wife had died, you know. So, you know what I mean? That's the thing that he goes back to, which, you know, it's
valid.
It's totally understandable, mm-hmm. but I don't know quite when that was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, yes, it's true.
Mm-hmm. And we really can't put a time frame on grieving. So you never know how he's grieving that, right? Because the last outrageous or burst of behavior was with the young lady that he hooked up with, who he had, you know, did all these drugs and all this stuff with. So, like, you know, trying to still do it, because we use people and use things too. So just using her to help him, to distract him from everything else that was going on in the house. I get that. You know, he was back in property taxes and all this other stuff was going on. And I thought it was real cool that his sponsor knew of someone who was of detox soon, who had a job and rented a room from him to help with the expenses, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I thought that was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he has a sponsor. He claims to be going to a lot of meetings.
With someone that's of his...
I'm not sure how much he's internalizing the message.
Right.
That's what I was getting at.
Yeah.
I mean,
uh-huh.
it's like...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know we're live. but, you know, some people, it's like the lights are on, but no one's home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's like they're physically where they're supposed to be, but mentally somewhere else.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that unless we're able to get them that to be evaluated,
mm-hmm.
so that we know
how
best to help them.
Right, and I don't know
how
that happens. That's the frustration.
Well,
the court doesn't, you know.
No, one thing Rachel said was they have to be willing to go for psychological testing.
Right.
Well, he might be. I don't know. I don't know whether we've even asked him, but you'd think the court would want it.
Well, the thing is, though, is that here's the thing.
It's not a question of his psychological. There's no mental illness there. They want him to address the alcohol.
Right.
Because this incident, whatever happened, took place when he was drinking and using, right?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't about his depression or anxiety or suicidal ideation. That had nothing to do with the charge or the mandation that he received from.
Thing is, too, their bare minimum is whether or not a person is fit to stand trial. So if when they ask you like a series of very short questions, if you're able to answer them, I'll bet in a tangential way, but if they're able to ascertain what you're saying, they believe that you are fit to be at the hearing. especially if you have representation. You're not just there representing yourself. You have legal counsel. They're going to therefore assume that that you're being fairly represented because you have someone talking for you. So they're not going to require that. If it was more of like a smaller court where it was just you and another party, like the plaintiff, but no lawyers, it would be much more strict in being able to check to see whether or not the defendant is able to stand trial.
Right.
But because you have legal representation, it's not as heavily thought of because you have someone there to speak for.
Right. Well, luckily he's given up that idea of representing himself.
All we can do is ask if the person is, if we deem that the person is not a danger to themselves or others. There is not much we can do because the person is an adult, not a minor. Minors, they still have rights, but they have their rights are more restrictive. And being an outpatient setting too, there's even less that we can do than unlike an inpatient. You're here, you're receiving treatment inpatient. The psychiatrist can very easily sign you up for psychological testing by a psychologist.
Absolutely.
No problem.
And this is what my patient wanted to do, the one that's now at NYMEE. She wanted to get her daughter into a hospital so that while she's there, she could make the recommendation that she comes and see another psychiatrist, because the psychiatrist that the daughter has is not being very effective. Her daughter's taking every medication that they have out there. She doesn't take it, and you can't make her take it. So it's just like, okay, let's start all over again. Let's do a reevaluation. Let's see where you really are, and see if there needs to be any changes in your treatment, right?
Well, and that's where one of the most difficult things that come out, because especially in the field that we are in, you have those that are certified, you have those that are licensed and to practice, but the vast difference is not in diagnostic ability,
right?
It's in
right.
What's the end goal? And a lot of substance abuse counselors and therapists, they most likely focus on either environmental or emotional change. Which, here's the thing, environmental change is, it's fleeting, because no matter where you go, there you are. You're still you. And if you're not dealing with the in-depth piece, it doesn't matter. So once you get comfortable in your new surroundings, you'll go back to old behaviors. And emotional change. Okay, so, if I just sit back and I just sit up straight and I feel better, okay, that'll help short term. But we're still not addressing what's really going on. But a lot of people, they feel comfortable only addressing those issues. But they're not really looking at helping people get that long-term change. It's just more about how long can we keep a client coming in.
Exactly.
Rather than how can we help this person have a better outcome for their life.
And you have a lot of people speaking out about this now. The bogus treatment that is being passed off as, professional, and it just gives the whole field a bad name, they're doing absolutely nothing, nor do they know what to do, because there's no end game, there's no planning, you hold them totally dependent upon, your instructions, and so you're getting paid. you know, and nothing is happening.
Mm.
And you have a lot of people speaking out about that now.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think that's one of the follies of client-centered therapy alone.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you give the client full onus of what's going to be discussed in session without really helping them go deeper, they'll talk about the weather for 45 minutes, or they'll get to a point of catharsis, but no action. So each week it's like they get a high and they get addicted to catharsis, getting that aha moment, like, oh, I'm this way because this is what happened to me when I was 4, or this is what happened to me when I was 13, and this is why I do the things that I do. But no change happens thereafter.
But here's just to, you know, go back to the handout that you gave, I think it was 2 weeks ago, because I was in here last week, turning the unfamiliar into something familiar, and turning familiar into something unfamiliar, you know, that kind of thing. Action, that whole action piece, motivating individuals to do for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Identifying what it is that you want and why you want it, and then moving in the direction of what you want. Because the how no longer matters, because you're moving, you have already set your intention, which is this is how I want my life to look. And if you're any decision that you make thereafter, if you put it through that lens, it'll eventually get you there. So it's no longer about how, and it's not so much even about when, because you know it's on its way. As they say, the check is in the mail. It's only a matter of time.
Yeah. This is true. I tell you, I had a very enlightening session with the young man late this evening, and he was struggling with whether or not to share his thoughts about his commitment to recovery. And he said, to be honest with you, if I can, I am definitely not all in. I know the steps to take. I get it. I get the information. But I can't honestly say that I'm all in. You know, I was like, wow. Thank you for sharing that. And so he was feeling pressured, because he go to the meetings and that kind of thing, and he was feeling pressured to fit inside the familiar, right? Which was very unfamiliar for him. And I thanked him for sharing that, trusting me enough to share that with me. And I said, wow, you're not all in, right? And you're not, and it's, and apparently it was so uncomfortable for you to pretend like you were all in and you were not. It was causing some anxiety. He said, yeah, I was a little bit stressed, you know. And he wanted to know what our practices were for abstinence. I said, it all depends on the individual. He says, well, I was tempted to go and buy some gummy bears from one of those trucks. I said, why didn't you? Why didn't you? Right? Because that's your curiosity. You wanted to know. Why didn't you? He said, well, you know, not everybody feels that way. I can only talk that way here. But whose recovery is it? Your recovery is not going to look like anyone else's recovery. I'm sorry. That's just not going to happen. But you're an adult. You get to do whatever you want to do. It's your decision. So I've been working on giving the reins back to them. Like, here's your strength.
Yeah.
There's nothing no one can do with your decision or how you feel and your thought process, right? We only discuss it in terms of whether if there's a need for some clarity on anything. But otherwise, those are your thoughts, they're your feelings, and the way you want to build your recovery is your own responsibility. No one can say that. I come to a group and in session with this information, but that's all I have is information. It's not there to convince you to use or not use. That's not really the goal for behavioral therapy. It's not the goal. That's on you. You're being assisted. We have MAT we're offering here, medication-assisted treatment, and then you have the behavioral component. You get to decide what you would do, what you want to do, or how you're going to respond to anything on a day-to-day basis, which is, you know, how you self-care, mm-hmm. right? And his body language just said, oh, my God, what a relief. Mm-hmm. I said, yeah. How long you been holding that? He said, for as long as I went back to the meetings. Because if I dare say that there, they would be all over me. Because I'm not speaking the language.
Okay. Well, I was very, commended my chant this evening, whom I've met, I guess, now three times. He works in the construction industry, and he says 85% of the people in the construction industry are high or drunk. Mm-hmm. 85%, okay? So he's had a few shots at recovered sobriety in the past. So this last time, it was worse. In other words, the addictive behavior had gotten much worse, whereas before it was painkillers because of an injury on the job. It had now gravitated to heroin use. So he needed to address it, and he realized that it was pretty obvious to other people on the job, you know, that he was high, even though he was in a senior management, like, supervisory role. Some kid came up to him and asked him if he had anything, and he realized, whoa, it's obviously showing, you know. Not that it was, he claims, affecting his work. Anyway, this weekend, you know, he's had the Vivitrol, I guess, in his system now for, I don't know if it's a month yet, but... he was offered an overnight shift, which he knew was something he'd never done sober before, ever. And he agreed to switch the shift with another worker to avoid doing it, because he figured, you know, I don't know what that's like to do an overnight shift and be sober.
Wow. Yes, it was. Yes, it was. Congratulations.
Yeah,
yes, it was.
Yeah, no, it was.
Yes,
I was
yes.
Quite
wow.
So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what's even better, really, for me, was that during that, he switched to a daytime shift that was equally boring, but at least, you know, he could, well, he forgot his iPad, so he had nothing to do. He had to sit in a truck all day where it was pumping out something or whatever on the site. So it was a completely lonely, boring 8-hour shift, but at least it wasn't overnight. And he managed to use part of that time during that very boring, lonely shift in the truck to have a conversation with his wife.
Wow.
Nice. Which he said was, you know,
yeah.
was really, you know, productive.
Yeah.
And
if yeah. you're not going to drink and use, then what are you going to do? There's so many options. You know, start dating your wife again. You know, how about that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
It's called recovering, right? Mm-hmm. From those old routines, and they're boring.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Oh, you have the therapy schedule there? No, that's not that.
No, it's there, isn't it?
Okay, no, I took that off. I thought they made a copy. I didn't see the original. Well, thank you all for this evening's taping. Yes,
thank you.
Yes. And
you'd always be here.
Yeah, I'm always. It's always a pleasure meeting with you guys and just discussing and talking through some things. Thank you for your support in that. We'll see you same time, same channel next week.
All right.
Yes. Okay,
so we were talking about, good evening, first of all.
Good evening.
So we've been putting our heads together to understand the motivation for another shot at recovery by a particular returning patient whom we've all had experience working with mm-hmm. in the course of the last at least 5 years,
yeah.
probably longer.
Mm-hmm.
This is a patient whom we've seen here in this recovery facility probably six different episodes of treatment, right? This is a man who's in probably his early 50s. And presents as a very thoughtful person who worries about meeting his obligations, his responsibilities, work-wise. And every time we work with him, he seems to be serious about wanting sobriety. And yet he's back, because each time he's come, these commitments that he makes to himself, he doesn't seem to be able to keep. And I don't know, we don't know exactly what the latest relapse history has been, but something about him wanting recovery keeps him returning to us. Now, my question is, if he's unable to keep that prior commitment to recovery, in other words, he leaves, completes treatment, does some time, and yet something happens and he's back, does that mean that what we worked on previously was not as effective as we thought or as he hoped? Or what is it that he was unable to do himself to continue to maintain his sobriety, and what perhaps should we be doing differently?
Oh, okay. Well, one of the things that happens, especially with the brain, is the brain can take us into sobriety, the brain can kick us out of sobriety. What I have found keeps people motivated in the long term is how they link their heart. Heart is where we keep our desires. It's what motivates us to do things long term when things get difficult. It's the resolve that we've kept to ourselves. It's why, we make decisions to go on diets and say, like, you know, I need to eat healthy. And we start off great. We create plans. We create scheduling. But if we're not doing it for the reasons that we can, that energize us, we're now focused on only doing it by sheer willpower. And as we know, we have only a certain amount of willpower each day. And if we're so focused on, do I not do something or do I do it, we end up draining that willpower. Eventually we get to a point where we say, the hell with it. You know, I mean, this is too hard. Because, well, we didn't really make a lasting choice of creating a full lifestyle change. We just decided that we're not going to pick up. We're not doing anything different. And I think that's where a lot of people struggle with, not only with addictions, but even with making minor lifestyle changes. Because we haven't discovered our why. Why are we doing this? Why are we maintain it? And sometimes people are like, well, you know, I want to lose weight because I want to, you know, I want to look good for this event. Okay, so we set up a short-term goal, we achieve it, and then once we've done that, we go back to our old habits. We haven't made lasting change. We haven't said, like, we haven't set out anything long-term. Sometimes that's what happens. You know, a lot of times clients will set up short-term goals in sobriety.
I mean, in this particular case, I almost wonder if there is actually a lifestyle to change, because when I was working with this patient, his life really consisted of working and trying to pay the bills, right? So there wasn't really much else going on in his life. And so maybe that's kind of the relapse risk right there, because... You know, he has
probably also for very good, maybe because of financial reasons, he doesn't really have the available cash to, you know, to involve himself in
mm-hmm.
other pursuits that might he find pleasurable and rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, you know, if that's the case, then somebody is going to be probably drawn back to using, to try to dull the
mm-hmm.
quote-unquote boredom, the monotony, the tedium
right.
of a life that is not varied enough
mm-hmm.
to keep them, you know, straight and clean.
Right.
Right? So it's this challenge, right, for
mm-hmm.
the person who's giving up the substance, be it, the, you know, the alcohol or the illicit drug,
mm-hmm.
To try to create a more interesting lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
varied pursuits that they would enjoy and get engrossed in to fill the time,
mm-hmm.
right, that they would otherwise be wasting
mm-hmm.
in their use, in their drug addiction or alcohol addiction.
Absolutely. And, you know, and sometimes you even hit find people, and this client in particular follows what's known as a boom and bust cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So he has a boom. He starts working. He then has an apartment, able to start paying rent because he has a job. Everything looks good on paper.
Mm-hmm.
But with these new... the word I'm looking
obligations.
For. Obligations and achievements.
Okay.
Now, responsibility rises.
Mm-hmm.
And with responsibility comes stress. And if he does not know how to manage
mm-hmm.
his stress, he's like, well, you know what? It was simpler back at the shelter.
Mm-hmm.
It was simpler
right.
using. All I had to do was focus on how I was going to use for that day.
Right.
And it was a lot simpler. I didn't have to plan my life. Because I now have to budget. I can't just go buying things. Now I have responsibility. So self-sabotage kicks in. How can I make it simpler? Well, I can do these things. And I can make my life very simple. I have my meals provided for me at the shelter. I can have a check. I can apply for unemployment. I can apply for these things because I can... do just enough where I don't have to quit. I can get fired. And if I'm fired, I can collect unemployment.
Right. So, the presumably the drug use is not condoned in the shelter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
may not be condoned, but
okay, it still
same.
Happens. Yeah. Right. Okay. So this individual or an individual in these circumstances has very little motivation. You know, to get him on himself on or herself onto a different path.
Mm-hmm.
So where is the growth? You see, this is my question, is that, you know, here's somebody who's been back with us now for half a dozen times.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I question whether we are somehow, are we failing this patient? Or is the patient, I don't know what the answer to that question is.
Mm. Well, thing is that we show up for our patients,
mm-hmm.
but we cannot control their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to make sure that we're not enabling them
mm-hmm.
in the sense of that we're giving them a free pass, but that, you know, they're held to the standards. And thing is that what is learned cannot be... taken away. If we've expanded this person's mind in knowing what they're doing and exploring these things with them, even if they do make the choice to relapse and go back out, the time spent is actually shorter because they can no longer do it in bliss of not knowing. They now know the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So that's generally what brings a person back, because they cannot enjoy their high because they know what's on the other side, even if they're not yet ready to make that last thing.
Mm-hmm. I don't know whether this person has been in a different treatment facility, you know, where there was more intensive you know, care, like mm-hmm. a higher level of care, maybe an inpatient, or maybe that, you know, this person needs more than what we offer, which is, you know, 3 times a week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and that's all grand, but that still doesn't help them in the sense of, that'll get them days, but it won't get mm-hmm. them lasting change. Because most of the time, it's just, you know, removing a person from an environment, wherever you go, there you are.
Mm.
You're still with you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in order to begin even helping them with behavioral change, we first need to understand what their beliefs are
mm-hmm.
in themselves.
Okay.
Identifying what their beliefs and their thought process is. Because if we identify that, now we can start giving them alternatives. Because a lot of times people believe things as from their perspective and their perception, how they perceive things, as big truths, as absolutes. The truth is that because we deal with people, we don't know what other people's motivations are. We only know our own because we've actually thought about what our intentions
mm-hmm.
are. Other people, we can only perceive them by their actions and then make assumptions based on their actions. So that's how we have to also teach our clients how to think.
Mm.
That not everything is in absolutes, but everything can be other perceptions based on the story that we're telling ourselves.
Right.
So we need to find out what's his story.
This all or nothing thinking, right? That can trip us up.
Yes.
Right? Or even the perfectionism,
mm-hmm.
right? That can stop somebody from even trying something
mm-hmm.
different for fear that it's not going to ever be, you know, good enough or good as what the person would hope for themselves or
mm-hmm.
that they could actually achieve.
Right.
And so what I kind of find very interesting, right, and one of the things I want to keep myself very mindful of is when patients come in, we enter into a partnership with them,
mm-hmm.
right? And as such, it's about, I see that you're back. Let's take an account or make a list of what has happened,
mm-hmm.
you know, since your last encounter with us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've sat with this individual for some time, right? And I know that underlying mental piece, that bipolar piece,
mm-hmm.
is huge,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Very huge. When I met him, he told me about being with another therapist
mm-hmm.
who suggested that, or stated to him that I cannot continue to meet with you if you're still seeing this young lady he was seeing,
mm-hmm.
right? Because he had become very fixated
mm-hmm.
on this young lady.
Mm-hmm.
And through our sessions, he introduced me to the hero.
Mm-hmm.
He, in his younger years,
mm-hmm.
was actually the hero for his mom, right? She would bring these men home, they would be abusive, and she'd call him, and he'd have to take care of it. So he went about his life, his son's mother, other women that he were involved with,
mm-hmm.
and he would become their hero.
Mm-hmm.
He would save them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, anything beyond that, he's not capable of providing in a relationship. He has no boundaries,
mm-hmm.
emotional or otherwise, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's experienced trauma after trauma in this relationship with this young lady. We're talking physical
mm-hmm.
attacks and, you know, he's been physically attacked,
mm-hmm.
you know, and for what we know of, or what I know of, this the rapid changes with this patient, there are just certain things that I'm not capable of doing,
mm-hmm.
right? And his environment plays a major role,
mm-hmm.
right? And so when you say, I wonder, you know, when you ask that question, I wonder how helpful we are being. Well, the most important help that we can give is to have our door open.
Mm-hmm.
He comes back every time because he trusts that he's going to get what he needs in this episode.
Okay.
Right? And so he feels comfortable here.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's what we've done.
Okay.
He found, we've made this comfortable for him. He doesn't feel judged coming here. He comes and he's willing to talk about what has been going on. And after a few weeks of the sober time, he jumps right into how can he correct this very abusive fixation he has with this woman, because it's not a relationship, it's a situation. I remember his coming in and talking about how she had met this much younger man, and oh, that upset him so much. But the only conversation he could have about that, the only way he could describe that was that that young man doesn't know what he's getting into. She's going to hurt him. And I just want to go to the park where they sleep in the park and let him know that she's going to hurt him. Well, that's not why you're going to the park. We know that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You're going to the park because you want to know whether or not she is, you want to know if she's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You want to know whether or not she still has interest for you.
Mm-hmm.
And the only time she shows affection is when he gets these little odds and ends jobs and he can provide alcohol money or drug money, right? The young boyfriend has beat him up in the park, broke his thumb and everything, broken arm and all of that. And yet he goes back. And yet he goes back. So, again, as you were saying, I try to stay away from how he's decided to live in his life and just provide for him what he wants from us, right? And, you know, I think it's more about what he feels he's getting, right? As opposed to what we think we should be doing for him and how that should look.
Okay.
Right? Because we can get ourselves in trouble with that one. Yeah.
Absolutely. Because one thing that we have to remember is, especially as mental health professionals, is that we can only help a client insofar as they're willing to allow us to help them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if some clients, they're like, open book, like, what can I do? I want to make my life change. And then boom, like we never see them again. Maybe sometimes we'll see them in passing, or that they've moved over to the just regular checkup side of things, and we might see them in the, you know, in passing, but they're not back with us. And others, either they've haven't gotten comfortable with creating a sober lifestyle, or others, they're, you know what, they just need someone to talk to every couple months when they're ready to give another go at it.
I'll never forget that traumatic thing. And every
time
I think about him, I think about this patient that I had, the one I said was dating the transvestite who was stronger than him and bigger than him, but was absolutely gorgeous. And how I worked very hard with, Red Cross. Was it Red Cross that I made contact with? They come out and they help with day-to-day, daily tasks, that kind of thing, right?
Visiting nurse?
The visiting nurse service, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was, and I inquired about, you know, patient's protection.
Mm-hmm.
And that was only available for elder care. Not for him. But what they were able to do was to move him out of that situation, place him in a secure situation, so they thought, until he invited the person over there. and something went awfully wrong, and this person beat him within inches of his life with a table leg. When the worker went there from visiting, no, she said that there, it looked like a murder scene. There was so much blood, right? And after that, he was hospitalized. They fixed him up a little bit, right? And he went back again. Second time, this person demanded that he be a part of a trio in sex.
Mm-hmm.
And that he needed to put this, what they call this cock ring on, mm-hmm. right? And it was shoved on so tightly, right?
Mm-hmm.
That he started to turn blue there,
mm-hmm.
you know? And he sat with this on all night, trying to plead with this person about how wrong this was and how he was being told that you love me, but how's this love? And then when he came to me, he said, but you don't understand, Pat, this person has experienced so much trauma. So much trauma. I can't just press charges. So much trauma.
Mm.
You know, I can't.
Mm.
I won't press charges.
Mm-mm.
And in the group, there was this pride, this sense of pride, because, you know, he put it out there because he didn't have any problem with putting
mm-hmm.
it out there, right? And one of the guys said something about, well, why? I don't understand why. He says, because if you've seen her, she is gorgeous. And she would never look at the lights of you. She chose me.
So there's a vanity there, really, right?
I didn't understand it. I was traumatized at the end, to tell you the truth. I wasn't sure where to put that. And so I needed to, you know, sit in supervision. And I think I met with you guys about it. Sure, we talked about that.
Nice.
Yeah, and it is one of those cases that I've had that has followed me throughout my career. It was so traumatizing. I had never seen such invited abuse, intentional abuse, and have it be interpreted as some human kindness being shown toward this abuser. That was a lot for me.
The Stockholm Syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think is what it's called.
Stockholm. Ego.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of ego in there.
But he was very bipolar too. And I think there was some other personality disorder going on there. You know.
A lot of co-occurring things happening all at once. But yeah. Like, and it's very difficult, especially when we're in a facility like this, to know where to go with it, because it's not like a private practice where you can refer out all of this.
You know, yeah, but you know, he was very connected to to appropriate resources.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Domestic violence, yeah.
He was there. We had the visiting nurse in place.
Mm-hmm.
He was over at GMHC.
Mm-hmm.
He was very much a part of them. He's a longtime patient of theirs, I think, over there.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that he could actually hear was that you must take your meds, or you must do A, B, C, and D in order to keep your funding for housing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he would do just enough to keep the funding back for housing. She needed somewhere to live.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, that to me, we've had this type of situation before. And this is where the quote-unquote, the mental health piece comes into question, in my view, right? Because there's that awareness, that conscious manipulation, right, of resources to enable, in this case, a situation which is at the very least dysfunctional, and more likely to be just, you know, highly abusive, mm-hmm. right? So what is the secondary gain?
Right, and how do we know if we're not being enabling, as you said prior in this discussion,
mm-hmm.
what's happening there? Right. Like, how, what is this person actually coming for?
Right.
We have the open door, we meet him where he's at, and are we practicing enabling practices, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think it also comes from intention.
Mm.
You know, we have the open door because we want our clients to feel welcomed and safe, that this is a safe environment. We do challenge. We don't just let them walk all over and do. We have our standards, and they have to meet them. Otherwise, we will have to refer them out in that sense. But if a client is openly inviting themselves to be put in harm's way, therein lies the boundary. We cannot physically restrain them from themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Especially if they're saying, like, this is what I want.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and unfortunately, that's what happens when we have free will.
Mm. Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
We're free to make our choices, but we're not exempt from the consequences mm-hmm. of those choices.
And I felt some sense of
And our heart goes out to the patients because we want to sometimes be able to protect them from themselves. But I think right now, the way things are in society is that we're like, when does that end up infringing on human rights also?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got such comfort and relief when the visiting nurse came here, met with me,
mm-hmm.
and asked about my assessment of it, and they're actually going out
mm-hmm.
and walking him through this process and placing him in this supposedly safe environment, mm-hmm. right? And I left it with how important ADL is going to be in this person's life,
mm-hmm.
and they said that, you know, this is something that's a service that we provide
mm-hmm.
if the person is deemed sort of disabled in that way,
mm-hmm.
and so I'm not sure if he met that criteria because
mm-hmm.
when you spoke to him,
mm-hmm.
he spoke very clear,
mm-hmm.
he was very
mm-hmm.
present, he's very aware,
mm-hmm.
you know, it appeared,
mm-hmm.
you know. But his behavior says something totally different. But what I needed to do, I felt at that moment, was to get all these service providers in place
mm.
so that I wasn't the only one attempting to service this person. I
mm-hmm.
needed
mm-hmm.
their assistance,
mm-hmm.
right? And that was great for me because I had no idea what to do with that.
Right.
No idea at all what to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so he met with them. This patient was a very personable person, and they liked his personality just as we did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's very pleasant to talk to and be around. Right. He also had a kid. He had a son. As this current patient
mm-hmm.
has a son
yeah.
who's made him a grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And. I hear spurts of reality from him when he
mm-hmm.
talks about, you know, my son asked me the question about, when my granddaughter turns one, can I just show up for her birthday? And I just want to show up for her birthday
mm-hmm.
for him,
mm-hmm.
you know, of the guilt,
mm-hmm.
the shame.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make it up to him,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But not... As not having the ability to commit to, like you were saying, Pasquale, that the level of responsibility that takes,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah,
yeah. I think we get time and time again, and it's very humbling to measure to note how persons whom we treat and who may end up leading very disparate, possibly criminal, maybe addicted, whatever, with these different problems, but how, despite all of that dysfunctionality, their parenting is really extraordinarily loving and meaningful, and that they are still, they still have these relationships with these kids, you know, that is very, very treasured and precious and affectionate and nurturing. And it's almost, it's hard to understand how those two can almost be reconciled, but they do.
Mm-hmm. They do. And so when we, I'm very careful when I use words like dysfunctional or chaotic, or because if that unit works, then there's nothing chaotic or dysfunctional about it, because it works, right?
It works for them.
It works for them, absolutely.
Well, I meant dysfunctionality in terms of the actual choices that this person is making in their own life,
rather
than the relationships that they're able to keep with their children, which, despite that dysfunctionality, they still seem to be able to keep those ties and to nurture those ties.
And I think for me, one of the biggest things that jump out at me is this lack of self-care. It's always about the kids, right? Or being the savior or the hero of someone else, right? And there's this absence of self. I think that's most... don't know, like, well.
Yeah, because what would that be like, having a relationship with themselves?
But do you believe it's in there somewhere? Do you believe it's in there somewhere? Like, we were all born with everything we needed to navigate in this world. And yet some of us are born lacking the chemicals that is needed to keep us balanced and mentally healthy, right?
Yeah, and I think that that nurturing piece, though, is so key, right? Because if we don't have a nurturing foundation from a parent or a caregiver, you know, who encourages this responsibility, really, this skill in practicing self-care. I mean, the self-care can start very, very young, right? Teaching the child that, yes, you are worthy of your own love for yourself, right? And, you know, we love you, but you know, you love yourself. And how do we show how you love yourself every day?
And I always say to my grandchild daughter, I like the way you care for you. I like that you're washing your hands. I like that you want a clean face. I like the way you care for yourself, because, again, and I had this conversation today, we can list things that we feel may be of help, but how aware are we of whether or not that individual is able to or is capable of
recognizing
this. So I am back to how to. You were told this. Do you know how to? Those very small steps, you know. But yeah, I agree with you. I think that nurturing is so very important to the human being in whatever form. And when that bonding doesn't take place, here's what we sometimes see, right? So, guys, should we end it here and just wrap up the session?
Yeah, I think we can summarize.
Well, I want to thank you for joining me yet again in Group Talk. Yeah?
Yeah.
And we will hopefully have more talk about self-care and some of what that entails. Thank you very much.
Thank
and
you
good
guys.
Night.
Have a good night.